call the meeting of the Joint Senate Transportation Committee and the House Transportation Committee to order. We're convening at 1:02 for the joint meeting. We have a presentation by DOT and Public Facilities, design concept, report on the day boat ferry, and immediately following our joint session, we will, Senate Transportation, believe it or not, will move to the Butrovich Room so we can complete and pass a bill that we had on the agenda last week. Also, Senate Transportation will hear public testimony. Following, and next Tuesday, on the design concept report, and that'll be Tuesday, I apologize, March 5th, and it'll be at 1:30. And with me, Senator...
Sorry.
Bishop. Sorry. Senator Dyson, co-chair, Senator French, myself, Chair Senator Egan, and Representative Wilson.
Okay. Present from the House Transportation Committee are Representative Feige, Representative Isaacson, Representative Gaddis, Representative Price Tompkins, and also myself, Representative Wilson.
And also staff today, Rebecca Rooney, staff to Representative Wilson, Dan Owen, staff to Senate Transportation, the Secretary Nancy Hemingway, and teleconference operator Sam Greeley. And I'd like to welcome Captain Falvey and Ruben Yost from Department of Transportation to give your presentation. And I apologize. My cold. Captain, it's yours.
Thank you, Senator Egan, Representative Wilson, and members of the Joint Senate and House Transportation Committee. As you know, on Monday we released the draft design concept report for the Daybone Alaska Class Ferry. And today what I'd like to do is run through the 10 slides that you have in front of you that summarize some of the main points from the report, and then we'll try to answer any questions you may have. So I'll begin with the first slide. So the first thing the report lays out is the mission requirements for the day boat Alaska Class Ferry. And this will be the next generation ferry in terms of we are looking at two ferries, Alaska Class Ferries for Lynn Canal. But I also want to emphasize that the report provides some information about how this class of ferry could be used on other existing routes and some potential future routes. And I'd also like to emphasize that when we are in the process of building a new ferry, we have the greatest opportunity to institute change. Whatever ferry we build is going to last approximately 50 to 60 years, and some of the basic elements that ferry includes will then control the operation potential for that ferry for that period of time. So we have an opportunity to make some changes. Obviously, changes are of concern to people. I think some of those changes will be very beneficial, and I think this report lays out some of that. So to get into the details of the mission requirements, this would be a roll-on, roll-off bow stern ferry, the idea being that vehicles all roll in one direction, and they all roll off in that same direction at the next port. So there's no sorting of vehicles based upon whether they're getting off at the next port or going on to another port. And there's no backing or turning for the vessels. So this is important for the vessel to be capable of operating as a 12-hour day boat. Basically, the 12-hour rule is that the crew works for an average of 12 hours. In fact, the schedule is supposed to be built around them in normal operations completing their cycle in 12 hours. That's particularly important in terms of looking at primary service in Lynn Canal. If the two vessels are going to replace the Malaspina, one of those vessels has to travel between Juneau, Haines, and back within that 12-hour period. So in addition to fast, roll-on, and roll-off, it's important that you have the capability for fast mooring so that the vessel can either back straight in or pull in bow forward, and that you have ability to load quickly. We also have heard loud and clear that people are looking for a seakeeping ability similar to the Taku. And another way of stating that is better than the Leconte in terms of winter operations. So John will be speaking more to that when we get into some of the details. And we want a minimum 99% sailing frequency. So basically we want the vessel to be able to sail in all but the most extreme weather. Okay. So if you look at those mission requirements that I just laid out, the next step is to say, okay, what are the vessel requirements in order to be able to meet that mission? We've come up with a basic overall length of 280 feet for this vessel. That's 260 feet at the waterline, which is approximately 40 feet longer than Leconte. In order to meet the schedule that we've laid out, we're talking about 15 and a half knots. That's not the maximum speed of the vessel. That's a conservative estimate of the speed that you need in order to stick to that 12-hour schedule. Question? I'm sorry.
Chairman.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, is that pretty close to the hull speed of the boat?
No, the hull speed would be closer to 16 and a half knots.
So that calculated.
Right. So, and I'll get into that in a little bit more. So. Okay, as I mentioned, we would, in order to accommodate bow and stern loading, there would be stern doors as well as a bow door. Most of our ferries now have a forward side door. But that means all vehicles have to either turn to get on or off the vessel, in some cases have to back onto the vessel so that they can unload at the next side load port. The bow would be designed to minimize spray. One of the issues we have with the Leconte is that both the bow and the side sponsons throw a lot of spray. In freezing conditions, that means that spray ends up freezing to lifeboats, the davits, other working gear, which is a safety issue. So. We also would need the capability to load aft port and starboard so that we could work at existing side load ports. We would need approximately a capacity for 300 passengers and a minimum of 53 Alaska Standard vehicles. An Alaska Standard vehicle is a measurement that AMHS uses. It's approximately a 20-foot long vehicle. So obviously there are vehicles that are shorter than that. And there's vehicles that are longer, but that's the way that the lane space is laid out. And we arrived at that 53 vehicles by looking at the current traffic in Lynn Canal and shooting for being able to accommodate 95% of the traffic days. So if you looked at through the whole year, between 95 and 96% of those days, we had traffic of 53 vehicles or less. There are some specific events that occur at the same frequency for events like Fourth of July weekend, the Haines Fair, the Klondike, the Kiwani. There are some other ones that we traditionally see year after year that we have a greater demand, and for that we would need to schedule some additional service. All right. The report that we released shows lots of different schedules, but the one I wanted to focus on today is the schedule for both between Juneau and Haines, and then Haines and Skagway. In order for people to travel to and from Juneau to Skagway, the vessel arrivals and departure in Haines have to be coordinated. So if you look at that schedule, you'll see that both vessels arrive at Haines at approximately noon. So that means that the Juneau vessel leaves at about 7:30 in the morning. And this schedule can be shifted. It's just that they need to be tied to each other in terms of the relationship. So it would leave at about 7:30. The vessel homeported in Haines would leave at approximately 9:30, would make one trip over to Skagway and be back in time to meet the vessel coming from Juneau. And on both vehicles, everyone would drive off. So if you're coming from Skagway and you want to go to Juneau, you would drive off in Haines, then you would drive on to the Juneau vessel. Same as if you came from Juneau and you arrive in Haines. If your destination is Haines, you leave the ferry terminal. If your destination is Skagway, you drive off the boat and drive on to the second vessel. A couple things I'd like
to... Joe.
Sure, excuse me.
Wilson.
Thank you. Are you using this schedule? Are you planning now? You're going to leave from Juneau and then go up to Haines and then back. Are you going to do that twice a day, or what are we looking at here?
Okay, on this schedule, and in order to accommodate that 95% traffic, there would be one trip from Juneau to Haines and back to Juneau. The Haines to Skagway vessel would make two round trips. And you need to do that in order to bring people from Skagway to Haines and then to take people who have come up from Juneau to Haines who are going to Skagway. So basically that means one round trip, Juneau to Haines, two round trips, Haines to Skagway. That provides for a 12-hour day for the Juneau Haines vessel. The other vessel is operating about 8 hours. So that means that on a 12-hour day, they have 4 hours available to service the vessel. For the 12-hour vessel that goes from Juneau to Haines and back, you need a night crew to service the vessel because they will have used up their available 12 hours just in the operation of that trip. So a couple things I'd like to... Excuse me, another question?
Representative Wilson.
I'll wait until you get done. And
sure, okay.
I've got
some of these things we may answer more as we go along. Another thing I'd like to point out about this schedule that isn't in the bullets, any of the bullets, is that these are much closer to daylight hours. You're departing at 7:30 in the morning. If you're heading northbound, you're departing either at noon from Haines or if you were traveling from Skagway around 10, and the vessel ceases operation, gets back to Juneau at around 6:30. If you try and do this same route with one vessel, the vessel has to start at 7 in the morning from either Skagway or Juneau. For a couple of years it ran from Skagway, started at 7 in the morning. You were asked to be there at 5 if you have a vehicle, and you would get to, at the end of the trip, it would be 11 p.m. That's when the vessel would tie up, so then you would wait your turn to unload, and then you'd be on your way. So now we're talking about a trip that occurs in a condensed period of time. Okay, so we took the mission requirements and then looked at the vessel requirements and then came up with a roadmap design. And I want to emphasize that a roadmap design is just one example of how you could meet the mission requirements. So it doesn't mean that what you're seeing here is what the vessel will look like. It means it could look like this, but it will look fairly similar in terms of length, the number of cars it can carry, the number of passengers, the fact that it'll have a clamshell-style bow, and it'll have stern center doors. But in order to come up with a cost estimate, we need to have a design that we can then evaluate the space, the amount of steel it takes to enclose those spaces, and come up with what's called a parametric estimate. So I'll get into that in a minute. So as we said, an overall length of approximately 280 feet. The beam is shown there. That's in order to have five lanes, four roughly 8 to 8.5 foot lanes and a 10-foot center lane for commercial vehicles. There's the service speed. Senator Dyson, you had asked about the schedule speed is built at 15.5 knots. The vessel would be able to travel 16 knots at 85% power, and then would have a sprint speed higher than that, 16.5 knots or a little bit higher. So passenger capacity is laid out there, the vehicles. The roadmap design is based upon 2 3,000 horsepower engines. And now I'd like to talk real briefly, and John will also address this. You've heard a lot about the fact that people are concerned that we're contemplating an open deck. What we are actually contemplating as a potential cost savings to be analyzed in the next step of design is a partially open aft roof. So one part of the car deck would be exposed, but it would be surrounded on all sides by an 18-foot-high bulwark, which, with the door being approximately 6 feet above the waterline, means the total height of the enclosure is 24 feet. So we're basically talking about it potentially being open to the sky, but well protected from sea, water, as well as spray. So, and you'll see that better when we get into the line drawings for the roadmap design. All right. This is a side view of the roadmap design. I want to point out a couple of things. You can see the clamshell bouts, obviously closed in this view. You can see there's no forward side door. There's no sponson. And John will speak to that in just a minute. And you can see the aft deck is surrounded by the 18-foot bulwark that I mentioned. And there's a person standing in front of the door, just to give you a sense of scale of how high the stern of the vessel would be. So, John, maybe you could speak a little bit about both the North Sea bow, the lack of sponsons, and the potentially open aft deck area.
Through the chair, for the record, Captain John F. Alvey. Yes, just to address the bow configuration. Presently, the inland certified vessels that we run, the mainliners, the Mal, the Matt, the Taco, they have forward corridors. Okay, of course, they have a stern corridor also. But quite frequently, ships of this type of certification are designed with what we call sponsons. And sponsons run the entire length of the ship, but they also run, in this case, forward to just slightly forward of the corridors. They're put there to not only, you know, support the corridor open, it creates a little more room to maneuver around the car deck, and there are some stability benefits of the sponsons. But three of our ships, in essence two of the ocean class ships, the Kennecott and the Tostamina, do not have sponsons. The sponsons do absolutely tend to create slamming and excessive spray. We need to be very careful with the inland design boats. Let's say, for example, a 235, the Aurora, that we are bringing, in essence, across the Gulf of Alaska during the winter time, simply because not the size of the boat, but the slamming problems that we have, and we have to wait for weather windows and whatnot. So, also, the Lituya at 198 feet is built without sponsons. She has what's called a modified North Sea bow. That kind of a bow has a lot of flair.
Madam Chair.
Okay, where on here are those sponsons? Can we see them?
You can in this particular view because this vessel will not have sponsons. But a couple slides on, we'll have a comparison slide that shows the Lakonde, the Roadmap Alaska class ferry, and the Tostamina, and you'll see where the sponsons are on the Lakonde.
But this vessel isn't going to have them?
Correct.
So why are we talking about them?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we're just trying to make our case regarding the seakeeping ability of our roadmap vessel is what we're trying to do. The roadmap vessel will not have sponsons that run all the way forward. There is a modified type of sponson, as you can see on this diagram, that there's another line here on the side that ends at a certain point. Yes, yes, Representative. And the key to this is the sponsons do not run all the way forward where the forward vehicle door would be. Okay, it's free of the sponson there, and the slamming that the ship is going to encounter is on the forward quarter part of the ship. That's where it's driving into the seaway, and that's where the slamming is going to happen. That's the point of impact of the seaway. So without that, and a bow configuration that is what we call a modified North Sea bow, which has a lot of flare. The bow comes up and flares away. Okay, a lot of our mainliners are not built that way. The Lakonde, the small Lakonde, is built with a modified North Sea bow. There's a modified degree of flare, and at 198 feet, that small boat is very capable, actually, in a seaway. So we feel that this sort of a combination will make for a very seaworthy vessel. I mean, when we start looking at this ship at 280 feet, say, for example, the Tostamina operates at 295 feet, and that operates literally in the worst weather conditions that we operate in, once again, without sponsons. The Tostamina has no sponsons, the Kennecott has no sponsons, and that really, truly assists in the seakeeping of the ship in general, along with, newer, modern, hull forms and whatnot.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Looks like I see a bulb bow. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Yeah, the bulb under the bow there, below water level?
Yes.
And I don't think you have that on many of your vessels, correct?
Most of our vessels do not have that. Bulb technology has come an awful long way, you know, regarding modern hull forms. And what the bulb does in the world of the naval architect, it reduces wave-making resistance. It makes the bulb much more efficient in the water, and it in essence creates a slipstream for the boat to run through. So, you know, very technologically complicated, but the bulb is has got to be there because it helps fuel efficiency tremendously on newer hull designs. Yes,
I would assume it gives you a little more buoyance forward and reduces pitch a bit.
Well, it does help. It does help that way. It's really there to create a slipstream. It reduces wave making resistance, which makes a cleaner glide path of the water.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Captain, continue, or Ruben.
Okay. Excuse me, I'll move to the next slide. The next two slides basically look at each deck level and identify what we envision at each one of those levels. So the upper deck is basically a crew lounge. The crew on these vessels will serve for 12 hours. On the fair weather, you know, when the crew takes breaks, on both fast ferries, they've identified the need for a little better area for them when they take their breaks. So that's what you see in the crew deck plan view. The next deck is the upper passenger deck. We envision that there'd be an area for a movie lounge, a quiet library computer room for people to work, laptops, read, whatever, and then another room that's a family / children play area. Where you know you expect to deal with some noise as opposed to the quiet library area.
Just a quick question, because we've had comments from constituents about people concerned that there is no Wi-Fi on the ferries. Are you planning on having Wi-Fi on these ships? So you can actually use the internet.
Mr. Chairman,
to charge for movies.
Mr. Chairman, regarding Wi-Fi, we are in the final process of installing satellite technology aboard the ships. In fact, we're installing two fast ferries this upcoming state overhaul period. And what we had attempted to do a few years ago was to install Wi-Fi in the ship. So, okay, and quite a few of the ships through the federal projects, you know, have hotspots installed, and we attempted that a few years back, and we were attempting that kind of out of, you know, in essence, out ahead of us trying to use the satellite systems for general communication back and forth to the ships, okay? And we had a problem doing that. We had a problem with broadband. We had a problem with the amount of broadband we had. To purchase broadband is very expensive per year. It's not inexpensive to have the broadband that we need. So what we did was we started a process a few years back with number one, getting satellite systems installed aboard the ships. That was the first thing we knew we needed to do. Okay, then we knew we needed to be able to communicate with the ships. Everything that our ship's crews need to communicate back and forth to the terminals, to the shoreside end, that takes X amount of broadband. Some of that broadband, we're moving diagrams back and forth for engineering and whatnot. So we've gotten to that point, and we know how much broadband we have and how much excess we have. Now, at the same time, we are in the process of building a new reservation system. That reservation system is going to go live onto the ships, okay? And this July, we will attempt another RFP. We were non-responsive a year ago. We think we've fine-tuned the RFP and the request to a point where we will be successful on this next attempt for an RFP. And what we really feel we need to do is to get the new reservation system up and running and get that running through the Wi-Fi, because the ships are going to go live with this reservation system, also to our call center in Juneau and to the terminals. And then we need to step back and look at how much available broadband is left to start working through the Wi-Fi type situation, and we may very well need to purchase more broadband, which of course is more general fund. Okay, so that's where we're at. But at the same time, we also need to realize that cellular technology is moving along, smartphones and things like that. There is more and more connectivity. There's more and more towers getting installed. Many locations along our routes, you know, already have the cell towers that people with their smartphones can get to. So we've got to look very closely at that technology and the ability that people have with their smartphones, even on the ships, weighed against what it's going to cost in additional broadband to provide the Wi-Fi. And we estimate that figure alone could be up around $500,000 a year just to provide the extra broadband for the Wi-Fi. Now, Oh, yes. We pay close to $1 million for just the broadband right now, close to it. It's very expensive. So we're looking at all of that, but we really feel logistically that we should get the reservation system up and running through the satellite system and then look towards whether it's a good idea to try to run the Wi-Fi through the ship satellite systems. It's on our mind. It's on our goals to do, but... It's in the plans.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Bishop.
Just one quick comment, and I'm glad to see that you're considering that, because the public comments and the written comments that we had from the young people, and I'm glad you see that you're taking those comments to heart. And I got to run to finance. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. My question is, and I have no idea all the rigmarole that you have to go through to do all this. However, have you got it narrowed down to a point of what you know you have to do to put it on? Because if you're going to do it later, it's always more expensive than if you do it now. And I'm just wondering what the difference there is.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we are installing the hotspots as we move through the larger capital improvement projects that is state dollar funded. We are installing hotspots throughout the ship, so that we will have the connectivity available once we get the broadband. We've actually looked into is there some way that. You could bring a provider in where, our customers would actually pay for the service. And when we thought about that, unless you're into large volumes, like, say, for example, the separate situation at Ted Stevens Airport, where you've got a large volume, so you're trying to get people to pay when they get close to those hotspots, that is not as easy to do without large volumes. And in our mind, our marketing staff really feels that if we're going to provide this is really more of a service Marine Highway System should provide, and it's a marketing tool. And if and when we do this, it should be a no charge type system, open to the public. So, but we are thinking about it. It is on the radar screen. We're just trying to do kind of one thing ahead of the other. And we do get a lot of requests. I'm answering a letter right now from a community that is requesting to know about it because of school children. And I understand that, and I'm going to answer that letter. And so anyways, yes.
Well, I know. I wouldn't pay. If I have to pay for it, I'll just...
Our thought is it would be a service we'd provide to the public riding the ships. Yes.
I don't want to upset my preferred carrier. But I made a mistake of subscribing and paying money for Wi-Fi on the airplane. Then you get north of Vancouver and it disappears. You know, I'm thinking, why am I paying this? At the end of the year, I'm not paying anymore. But it just the technology. It's improving.
It is improving, right? and we've had a very steep learning curve with it. As we tried to bring it aboard, we had it aboard the Malaspina for a while, and we didn't have enough broadband, and it just there's a lot of technology, and there's a lot of potential trails through trying to provide that kind of service. So it's on our mind. It's on our list, and we surely hope before too much time passes we'll have Wi-Fi on the ships.
Captain, I'm sorry I brought it up. Senator Dyson.
I am too. With the magnitude of the money and the issues we're discussing, it would seem unprofitable to pursue this one. Respectfully.
I agree. But we're talking, it could be close to $1 million per year when you're talking about the fleet, and we're getting constituent concerns, and that's why I asked the question. Captain, go ahead.
Through the chair, it's an expensive broadband. Is not cheap, and it's costly. But it does provide a tremendous service. It increases the safety on the boats. It's 24/7 communication. We've got the technology such that we're able to operate it with the boats in the higher latitudes. That tends to be a problem with satellites, believe it or not. Mountains blocking. We have about 95% reliability with these systems aboard now, but it's the broadband is not inexpensive per se.
Okay. The next slide shows the two main decks. The boat deck has the main passenger view lounge area. That's similar to a typical view lounge area on the existing vessels. There's an eating lounge behind that, and we are envisioning vending machines rather than food service in order to keep the cost of operation down. We'll look into, you know, the latest, you know, most sophisticated vending machines that perhaps can serve food that you can then heat up in a microwave so that there's more than just candy, you know, that kind of thing. But one way of keeping the overall cost down is to reduce the number of crew, and having crew dedicated to food service is one way of doing that. So I'd also like to direct your attention on the boat deck to the shaded area. That's an area of the boat deck that we're saying we should look at having be open. And if you just shift your eye down, we didn't actually draw a line on here from the boat deck to the car deck, you can see that the 53 vehicle spaces are displayed there. Each one of the rectangles with an X through it is one of the standard vehicle spaces. Of these 53 spaces, 33 of them are completely covered. In other words, they're up underneath the boat deck. And our average load in winter is approximately 25 cars. That's not to say there won't ever be cars that are exposed to the elements. But in general, our winter loads are half or less of our summer loads. I've also mentioned that we're investigating the possibility of this. John will explain why, what the cost advantages of that are. There's ways that we can have that deck be essentially open in terms of structurally and in terms of ventilation, but still covered so that we won't get snow on that deck, for instance, or ice forming. So, John, if you could explain the reason why we're looking at it in the first place. So.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Skettenfalvy. I think the first thing that we do need to understand is that, you know, this roadmap vessel that we have before us is a roadmap vessel. This along with the design concept report is a map to guide our primary naval architect group, LEP Design Group from Seattle, to go forward now with the envelope and the parameters that we have laid forth with this new concept. And we will look at both a partially open after deck and a totally enclosed deck. You can enclose the deck, maybe with a lighter weight material, but we also need to know that as we look at it both ways, there are some costs associated. With a partially open deck, number one, have less weight, which is, a savings as far as material. There are some reductions in heating and ventilation, as Deputy Commissioner had mentioned. But probably one of the, larger pluses to this is with a bow configuration where the bow opens, okay, and is not totally watertight, behind that opening bow are bulkheads. Okay, and in many cases, depending upon the class of vessel and the tonnage of the vessel, there could be up to two bulkheads. And depending upon whether this car deck space is technically enclosed, will depend, upon, what type of bulkheads you have behind this door that opens. There can be bulkheads that are actually watertight. There can be a requirement for one bulkhead. There can be a requirement for two bulkheads. There can be any combination of that plus, a bulkhead that's waterproof where some water can get through. And it has to do with the ability of water that may get through those bulkheads. A method and a way to technically clear itself, and not create free surface inside the car deck where the water get trapped, create free surface to one side of the boat and roll the boat over. So it's got to do with, Coast Guard rules, classification society rules, what type of bulkheads you've got to have behind those removable doors. But as I say, there are cost savings, but we also understand there's other issues, and we're going to look at it both ways and lay that out and be very open about that. But there are advantages to it, but we do feel that if it were open in the back, three quarters of the vehicles are still tucked away up forward underneath, in essence, in a heated situation, and are greater potential for sea spray swirling, back in there, up and over 14-foot bulkheads that are still 6 feet above the water, as Deputy Commissioner had said. In the wintertime, that's really when the chance of that happening is much greater. And, we do know that on average, not every single trip, but on average, a high percentage of those cars, because we don't carry the bigger loads that we carry in the summer, will still be tucked away and protected from sea spray. That's our thoughts.
Okay, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Wilson.
I guess the only thing that concerns me is having it as an open deck. I understand your need for weight savings. Two questions. Is it a waste of deck space for potentially other cargo, either outsized or oversized type cargo? And if you need to medevac somebody off the vessel, we're looking at a deck hoist type situation, or appears there's room in the back there for a helipad. I don't know if that would add to the weight considerably or not.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, those are all good points. We seldom medevac, although we have medevaced. We tend to divert ships. I diverted the Kennecott just this past week due to a crew member that was very, very ill. Okay, so the routes that we run, especially on this type of a vessel, the odds of a medevac, let's say, for example, a Lynn Canal, that's a dangerous procedure. I've done that at sea as a ship captain myself on large tankers. It's a dangerous maneuver. It's very risky for the Coast Guard and for our ships. So, on this particular vessel, in this particular service, it would tend not to happen as frequently, although that's not to say that it couldn't. But I do believe that, medevacing could happen on the bow of this vessel if we needed to, as opposed to, over the top of a potentially open but now closed car deck. If we do close it, it most likely would be with a lighter aluminum material, just for the covering aspect of it, and it might not, support that kind of an operation. But as far as the car deck itself, we roll on and roll off. We in essence, don't carry freight because we're really not insured to carry freight per se. But we should have equal access to that car deck for anything, right up to vans, 40-foot vans and whatnot.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Great. Thank you. Yep. All over. Chair Wilson, then Representative Christ Tompkins.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you're in the solarium, and where it says it's partially open, how tall is that going to be right there? I mean, if somebody can walk right out of the solarium and up to that edge there, how tall, how high is that going to be right there?
Chairman Wilson, Chairman Egan. If you see after that, you see it labeled as passenger walkway, there will be railings all the way around that space, the same as there are railing on the aft of an enclosed deck area. So
I understand that, but how high is it? I mean,
stories.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
See, so I mean, so somebody's not going to lean over and fall over.
Correct.
You know.
Correct. There would be railings all the way around that,
but
so they would have to hop a railing.
The one that I can see, the one side railing can be shorter because it's doesn't have to be. But the railing that you, because I'm what I thought I heard you say 6 feet. And is that going to be 6 feet right all along there?
No, the 6 feet I was referring to is the car deck is typically 6 feet above the water line, and those side walls, the bulwarks, are what we evaluated was 18 feet. So that would give you 24 feet from the water line. So I was describing that in terms of what the total height a wave would have to climb before it could come in that opening is 24 feet, which we don't experience in Lynn Canal. But in regard to your question, the railing would be the same height that would be that we have all the way around the aft deck on other vessels, so that a person would have to climb over a railing to get overboard. Well, it would be similar. They'd have to climb over a railing before they could fall into that car deck space, which would actually be less of a drop than if they fell overboard. Does that answer your question? That's true.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you know, a railing heights on any merchant ship, passenger vessels, there's certain standard heights that we have to abide to. I don't know off the top of my head what that height is, but there are certain standards for railing heights on passenger ships. So it would be a standard railing height.
Okay.
Okay, Representative Christ Tompkins.
What is maximum wave height on canal?
We're actually evaluating that. We have had analysis in the past that are based upon computer modeling from wind and wave data from Eldred Rock. I will find that for you, but if I said now, there's a good chance I'd miss it. I think it's in the neighborhood of 12 to 15 feet, but I will get you that information. And I'd also mention that we are preparing a more detailed wind and wave analysis and motion comfort, because it's obviously an issue with this vessel, and it's been an issue for Juno Access. All the alternatives have day boats that would operate in Lynn Canal, and so we realize now is a good opportunity to do a more detailed study and provide that. So it'll be available to the ACF design team, as well as being able to answer questions for Juno Access. So, let me write that down.
Depending on the results of that wind and wave study, is it possible that the design of the ferry would be modified to, I mean, say if the wave heights are larger than 12 to 15 feet or larger than whatever this design was predicated on, is it possible the design will change to accommodate that new seakeeping reality?
Yes, Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair. That's part of the purpose, is to provide that information to conclusively determine that we will be able to have the seakeeping ability that's comparable to the TACU. So,
to follow up on Representative Christ Tompkins, you know, I've been in Northern Lynn Canal going by Eldred Rock when it was like a 70-knot wind. But it was on the Malaspina, and it kept going to Haines. But what happens with this in an open stern when the weather really turns crummy and the spray, I mean, it's just, you know, you can look down Gastineau Channel and it's white. Everybody thinks it's fog. It's not fog. It's sea spray. You know, what happens when that ship has to turn around? And the spray comes into the open stern. I mean, that really worries me. It seems to me like you'd have to get a whole bunch of Marine Highway employees with blow torches to thaw out the cars so they can get off.
Well, Senator, again.
And we talked about that.
Right. First of all, you're talking about a fairly extreme situation. Second of all, those almost always occur.
Well, we have extreme situations.
Granted.
We have had cancellations of the Lakati more than once.
Correct.
This winter.
Correct.
You know, we have extreme situations.
Right. And that, John, can you speak to this in just a second? But the turnaround situations with the Lakati are primarily because of that ice spray freezing on the davits of the lifeboats. They don't threaten the stability of the ship. They threaten the ability to launch if there's a crisis with the ship for other reasons. But could you speak to that?
Mr. Chair, Just adding on to what the Deputy Commissioner, you know, had indicated, we you know, and I understand that the route between Metlakatla and Ketchikan is not the same route, but as, you know, the bus gets closer to Ketchikan, we do get, you know, some freezing spray and snow, potentially a lot of snow. And we have operated the Latoya in wind speeds up to 75 knots with a completely open car deck in Ketchikan in the wintertime. So that's extreme. It's an extreme situation. But
you don't have wind chills of minus 20.
But we can encounter some freezing spray there also during a very cold winter snowstorm per se. But no, you make a point. You make a good point.
Representative Christ Tompkins and Representative Isaacson.
So I appreciate the design aspect of the flared bow, and that's designed to minimize spray inland canal and hence freezing spray inland canal. And I mean, I suppose predominantly in the winter, it's a north wind inland canal. So you have this day boat heading from Haines back to Juneau, and you have a following sea. And I mean, what aspects of the design take into account a following sea in which the waves are chasing the boat, and you don't have a flared? Wind spray is coming from behind, not from in front.
Through the chair, Representative Grace Tompkins, technically a following sea is not as harsh because you're running with the weather. You're running with the wind. Of course, the wind may be blowing 50 knots on your stern, and the boat's doing 16 knots or maybe a little faster because it's got a following sea. But that tends to not be as severe of a situation as driving into a headwind and say, technically, because you're running with it.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I've been listening to this and pondering over, the death gulch, as the House Chair might have described it, part of it, what hits me, there's two thoughts. One is basically the fairness of the fees. It's going to be a lottery, essentially, or a mad dash to get there first so that you can be under the protected side, which leads to equity of charging people in the back the same as those in the front. The other aspect is this is really going to limit the usage of these ships. So these ships are really just going to be Lynn Canal only. You're not going to be able to divert them if you have a need elsewhere in the fleet.
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, we have shown, at least schedule-wise, that this vessel could go to Hoonah, to Angoon, to Tunique, to Gustavus, and it would be capable of dealing with weather on those runs. We've shown for extended voyages where to fill in for an emergency situation, going to Sitka and then housing the crew overnight on shore. This vessel would be designed for those weather conditions as well. So,
Mr. Chair, even with the back open, as it were, to capture a lot of moisture and freezing and such, it just seems... It seems strange that you have the open bay back there. It sounds like it's going to cause you more trouble in the future than...
Well, we're going to analyze that. But keep in mind that the top of that is 24 feet above the waterline in inside waters. So we don't get big swells in any of the areas we've just described. What we get is wind-driven waves. So.
Well, you have moisture flying.
Oh, absolutely. You know, they would be open to snow and rain, which is the same as any vehicle on any highway in the state. So,
of course, this is not a day cruise from up pure in Seattle to Bremerton. I mean, these are totally different weather conditions. And to follow up on Representative Isaacson and your comments, this ship, even though if it was covered, if you come up with a final design that with some lightweight covering, it still isn't SOLAS compatible, right? So it can't go across Dixon Entrance unless you get a waiver.
Representative Egan, it can cross Dixon Entrance. It can't go into British Columbia.
Okay.
It's the foreign port catch that
But it's
we get into a solus.
Solus.
Okay. Solus technically is increased safety regulations on ships that run outside of the inland international boundary lines. When you get into international waters outside, there are literally lines that are drawn all the way across, I mean everywhere in the world, that dictate whether ships follow the inland or international rules of the road. And once you get outside that boundary, then you get into solus regulation.
But I know the Malaspina and the Taku and the Matanuska can go to Rupert. I mean, we got hijacked.
Mr. Chair, the Matanuska, the Taku, and the Kanakata are the only three solus ships that we do have. We can secure waivers if we need to do an emergency trip. Yes, we can secure a waiver on a one-time, on a case-by-case basis to go into Prince Rupert, which is a foreign port. Yes, under solus.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Among the safety concerns that were raised to me when this concept was first put forth, besides an open deck, which I think we've discussed a little bit, is the clamshell roll-on, roll-off bow door, and the unsavory historical incident that's often cited is the MS Estonia in the North Sea, which sank with the loss of life of 850 people because the bow door failed because it was slamming into heavy seas. And the North Sea isn't the Atlantic, it's not the Pacific, but it's also got a lot of harsh weather and perhaps waves a little bit larger than Lynn Canal. But what safety considerations are being taken into account with this bow door? What ensures that kind of thing will never happen in the Southeast?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins. When the Estonian capsized, that was due to free surface. Yes, the bow door failed. Rules and regulations have changed, thus requiring internal doors, watertight doors, or waterproof doors, depending upon whether you have an open deck in the back or an enclosed deck. And over those 10 or 12 years, I think it's been about 12 years since the bow door failed on the Estonia. The vehicle deck filled full of water. Free surface took effect. There was nowhere for the water to escape. The water went to one side and the ship rolled over. So since then, rules and regulations have changed to require internal doors, more sturdy, if you will, internal bulkhead doors behind that moving bow, or I'd say bow or clamshell type door. So that has changed over the last 12 years or so to increase the safety of vessels that operate with removable bows. They're very common with ferry operators running large ferries in the North Sea. They're actually very common.
All right. Thanks. So just to clarify, there's basically going to be redundant doors in the bow.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, if we design a movable bow door, there will be bulkheads behind that to provide safety regarding the water tightness or the waterproofness of that vehicle deck, yes, to avoid free surface, yes.
Great. I guess just to add, and the Bartlett was in Prince William Sound forever, and you didn't have problems with that, right?
Senator, no, we never did have a problem with Bartlett.
Technology has gotten a heck of a lot better.
Technology has increased incredibly since then, yes, sir.
Continue. And I apologize, but we only have about a half an hour left, or less than half an hour.
Well, I'm almost saying
5 minutes.
I'll talk fast. This next slide is just a vessel comparison that shows what we're envisioning in terms of size, in terms of height of the bulwarks, the main bow. So you see the Lakani there at 237 feet. The last class day boat at 278, the Tustamine at 296. So I think the main point there is that this vessel would be closer in length to the Tusti than it is to the Lakani. And then you can see on the Lakani that black line running along it, that's a sponson running all the way forward. And not having that, or the need for that, because of the absence of forward side doors, will greatly increase the seakeeping ability.
What's the height of the stern on these three ships? Because you keep talking about...
Familiar, they're all to scale, so I've just mentioned that the height from the waterline of the last class ferry shown in the middle is approximately 24 feet. John, do you know the...
Mr. Chairman, I think it's approximately, from the waterline, approximately 6 feet to the, the edge of the deck, in essence. And actually, just a slight correction here on the profile of the Lacani, the sponson is actually the line that runs just below the cardiac opening and runs probably 6 or 8 feet forward of that. That's where the problem comes in having the sponson, where you see the modified sponson on the profile of the proposed Las Glas Ferry day boat. It ends much further aft in proportion to the bow configuration of the ship than you'd have on the Lacani. So it's about 6 feet above the waterline, 6 to 8 feet. The actual cargo. Yes.
Great. Thank you. Continue.
All right. Trying to move quickly here. Last but probably not least, we have some preliminary cost estimates, and the main purpose, by the way, of the roadmap concept design is to be able to apply costs to that design. In other words, we have features that we mentioned are part of the mission, but in order to evaluate those costs, you need to define the spaces that would be enclosed. So those line drawings were used to create a parametric cost analysis, and that's very typical until you have detailed line drawings for vessels. To look at the costs of recently constructed vessels and then look at the spaces they enclose, the type of spaces, high volume, low volume, high density spaces, machinery spaces. Using that type of analysis, Coastwise came up with a cost of first vessel construction between $45 and $55 million. I'm going to speak in round numbers. These are all to the nearest 100,000, but I think it's probably more important we speak in terms of the nearest million. So the preliminary engineering is based upon a fixed percentage of that, as is construction engineering. Construction engineering is AMHS, construction managers monitoring the construction.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
For the adjustments to the harbor itself, where they have to make adjustments for the front end roll-on, roll-off. Is that included in here?
No, Chairman Wilson and Chairman Egan, this is just vessel construction costs and project development costs. There, as I mentioned, I think at the last meeting, there will be required end berths, probably bow berths, at Haines, and we estimate that cost now at approximately $20 million. The 350-foot Alaska-class ferry also called for a stern berth in Haines, and that we had done much greater detail on. That was estimated at $18 million. Obviously, to have two stern berths as opposed to one large one is going to cost a bit more. They can use a lot of the elements in common. So that's an additional cost of putting this vessel into operation.
So do we... there's $117 million left, it says. We start out with, there's right, how much?
No.
That only leaves $10 million, right?
Correct. Even with the original last class ferry, the intention always was to do the terminal modifications in Haines as a separate project with federal aid. It wasn't out of the $120 or the $150 to $167 million estimate.
Okay, and we can do that because I know there's problems in Petersburg right now when we made the modifications to the terminal area. What happened was that now we cannot use that for anything else. It was made for the IFA ferry, and now we cannot use it for other things, and so it's sitting there with nothing happening to it. And so I'm just wondering, if we use federal money, then we will not be able to use it when we have ships that are all Alaska money.
Well, currently the Haines Ferry Terminal is only used by AMHS vessels. Most of our terminals are only available to AMHS vessels. And the design of this would be structured so that it doesn't preclude using the side berth that's already there. But we already have spent federal aid at almost every terminal in Southeast, so they're not available to be leased to the to a private entity.
Go ahead. I just want to make sure that we're not putting ourselves in the same situation that the Petersburg area is, because now that terminal is there, nobody's using it, and we can't use it. And if we do, we have to give $15 million back to the federal government, and I just don't want anything like any scenario like that to be set up.
Well, we currently, you know, have a federal aid facility at Haines, so adding a stern berth or two end berths there won't change that situation.
Okay.
So are we talking another $40 million then for terminal construction?
No, 20.
20?
$20 million.
20 per or?
No, 20 for a combined dual end berth facility.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we're still using the concept of getting this constructed in Ketchikan, so we're still not accepting federal funds, correct?
Correct. For the vessel.
Okay.
The fact that the vessel
is
federal
funds. But we can get federal money to construct the terminals?
We have for every ferry, as I said, for every ferry terminal that we have in Southeast,
okay.
I believe.
But
yeah.
This is different, sort of.
But this vessel has always been planned to call at federal aid modified terminals, so that is not a problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's out of the what we did with the Alaska class.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, we defederalized construction of the
right.
ferry. It doesn't affect the terminals.
Okay.
So.
Great. Thank you. If you could wrap up.
Sure.
And we're inviting you back next Tuesday.
Certainly.
We still have some questions.
Sure.
Go ahead. Sorry.
At any rate, the only other thing of real importance here is that based on Washington's experience and other places where two vessels, identical vessels, have been constructed by the same shipyard, one right after the other, we are projecting 10% cost savings of the second vessel. There's no engineering involved for the shipyard for the second vessel. They've already laid up the forms that they have. There's a lot of lessons learned in terms of how to be efficient in assembling the vessel. So we took the mid-range of the cost estimate, we also took the mid-range of the expected cost savings. I think Washington saw from about 8 to 18%. So we took 10%. And then on all of our projects, there's ICAP, Indirect Cost Allocation Program. So we're showing that. And it leaves approximately $10 million as a contingency. And as we move forward, we will be estimating the cost at each step. And if vessel costs come in, cost projections come in more than that $117 million, we're either going to make adjustments to the design or we would be then looking at additional funds. But at this point in our estimate, it looks like we can do what we said, and that is build two of these for the remaining Alaska-class ferry appropriation. So one last slide. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, this is just what our next steps are. We released the design concept report on February 25th. It's out for public review. It's on the website for people to look at. We've said that if people have comments that they would like to see addressed in the design study report, that they should get those to us by March 8th. It's not to say we won't address those comments, but the next step in the process is for the design team, Elliott Bay Design Group, to prepare a design study report where they analyze this design concept report and provide some more detail and analysis back and come up with a concept design, which then can have a parametric cost estimate, and then it will move to preliminary design the same way we would develop any capital construction project.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
To summarize the costs included with for modification or construction of ferry terminals, it sounds as though $20 million is required to build two berths in Haines, and other than that, no other modifications are needed for no other terminals in the system besides Tanaki, which is slated to undergo innovation anyway. Is that correct?
Yeah, Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair, that's correct. And that is a very approximate number, that 20 million, because we have not done the preliminary design for that. What's shown in this report, I think it's on page 25, is a conceptual design of how we could put two end berths there. As soon as we know the bow configuration, then we'll do some more detailed design. But the design marine section that designs marine terminals and modifications has said that's an approximate number to use. So.
Great. Further questions of the Deputy Commissioner and Captain? Representative Wilson.
Okay, thank you. And I appreciate your taking time to go over this with us. I do have some questions that people have already sent me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just going to let you know, and you guys can copy these down so that you have questions. The crew comparisons were there were 84 crew from the Malaspina to 44 for the shuttle boats. I don't that's kind of an iffy number because it needs a better explanation, because the Alaska class period was slated for 28. And so to go from the Alaska class period, which was bigger, to 44 for this one, I just didn't quite get that. So that's one. Somewhere along the line, was it mentioned that you wouldn't take anybody that was an unaccompanied vehicle? You wouldn't take that; they wouldn't be let on or off. Is that true?
Correct. In other words, every vehicle would need to have a driver, and every vehicle would need to have a power source. You can't achieve roll on, roll off if you have most of the vehicles driven off, and then somebody has to back a tractor in to haul off a trailer.
And so. I think that's something you really need to think about, because of the fact that from how are the people or freight, does that mean that they can't go through Skagway, they would only be able to go through Keynes? Because if we can't roll them back and forth an unaccompanied vehicle between Skagway and Haines, that means that things that are coming down the highway that we normally put a van on, drive it on with a semi-truck or something, you know, so how are they going to get their things on down? Because now they can do that, and they would have to go all the way around to Haines. So that's another question. And also, a lot of people up in Skagway also get delivery of all kinds of groceries and stuff. And so I'm wondering, how is that going to happen? Because many of the communities get groceries and whatnot from right now, and that's an unaccompanied vehicle lots of time. That's a van or something. So that's a question. And there was a question about eating out of vending machines. I don't have a problem with that, because airplanes are doing it nowadays. You know, they don't have anything like they used to, so I can live with that one. My question is, why does the one between Haines and Skagway have to be a 12-hour vessel? Because you can do that in much less time. So that's something to be thinking about. And then that's one thing. How long? Because we've got in some of that, there's 7 hours in there, and it only takes an hour, doesn't it, to get from between Skaggs and Haines, or does it take longer than that?
No, it's approximately an hour.
Yeah. So
I can explain that.
Yeah. All right. And then
we're going to have to wrap this
okay.
up.
Okay. Well,
we have another
I guess I can
get
sure. Would you like some quick answers to those questions, or would you like them later?
House Transportation is more than welcome to attend the meeting next Tuesday at 1:30 in Butrovich, but you're more than welcome to join us, because that's when we will take public testimony on the ACF, because we have a whole bunch of communities that want to weigh in, and for you two to answer questions, if that's okay with you. Representative Christ Tompkins, briefly.
Sure, I'll make it really brief. To elaborate on one of the questions that Representative Wilson just flung your way regarding unaccompanied vehicles, obviously the ferry system is a really important way for freight to move around the region. If all vehicles have to be accompanied, how much freight is no longer being able to move up and down Lynn Canal, and that a lot of freight currently moves on ferries right now, how will that freight otherwise move if it can't use the ferry system anymore? That's my question.
Can I answer that one, or you want to wait?
Well, or can you provide us the answer on Tuesday?
Sure.
Okay. I'll be there at 1:30.
Great.
Representative, yeah, you're more than welcome. Because we have to vacate this room because we have another committee that's coming in here. And Senate Transportation will be meeting for 5 minutes in Butrovich to clear up an issue that we had last week. It'll be very brief, hopefully. And then we will meet again next Tuesday, Butrovich, at 1:30. And we will accept public testimony and further questions from the Joint Committee on issues regarding the Alaska Class Ferry. And I thank you, Captain and Deputy Commissioner, for being up front with us, because there are a lot of questions from the people that we represent, and we appreciate you coming forward and giving us a lot of details.
We appreciate the opportunity.
But now all you've done is generate more questions. Anyway, I want to thank Nancy Hemingway, Sam Greeley, and Becky Rooney, and Dan Owen of Representative Wilson and my staff. So thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned, and again, Senate Transportation will convene in Butrovich in like 3 minutes so we can get out of there.
To order. This is the House Transportation meeting, and it is 2:15, and let the record show that representatives that are present are Representative Lynn, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Gaddis, and myself, Representative Wilson, and Representative Isaacson. So I would like to recognize that Nancy Hemingway is over here, our House Recording Secretary, and Sam Greeley is our LIO monitor, and my committee aide is Becky Rooney. Yep. And, and before we start, let's go ahead and make sure that your cell phones are off. And today we would like to, we have one bill on the agenda, and that's House Bill 23, the Kibata Bridge. And like other complicated bills, I plan on hearing all the comments from the sponsor and from the Kibata people today, and we'll put this bill aside then and have any questions from members, but there won't be any public testimony today. We will have this again at another time, and when we get, I think there's going to be a lot of questions from the committee when Kibata has the answers to those questions, then we will hear the bill again. So the bill is Representative Newman, and his Chief of Staff, Rex Shattuck, is going to present Kibata.
For the record, my name is Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Mark Newman. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we really appreciate the opportunity to come before you and talk about the Kinnick Arm Crossing. As many of you know, your schedules are very busy and complex, and you're in different committees all the time. Representative Newman is presently in finance and will be heading here as quickly as he can. So my part in this would just to be able to ask your indulgence in that until he gets here, and really turn as quickly as possible over to Mr. Mike Foster, first stating that HB 23 really amends the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority's enabling statute to provide for a successful procurement of the Kinnick Arm Crossing Project and to generate the best value for the state. This bill was written in consultation with the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, Kibata, and as such, they're very well versed and able to answer a lot of questions. If it would be all right with you, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Mike Foster to join me to perhaps get into talking about the bill, and then when Representative Newman comes down, he could give you the sponsor's philosophy and answer questions as well, if that would be all right with you.
That would be just fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Michael Foster, and I'm the chair of the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. We have a short presentation, realizing that we just went through many of these slides about 2 weeks ago in the joint transportation overview. If I could ask your indulgence, we'll go through them. I expect to be less than 10 minutes, and then we can get into question and answers. So, okay, just a sec. As we said earlier in the overview, Kibata was set up by statute in 2003 for the purpose of advancing the Kinnick Arm Crossing. You see on the slides there is, I'm sure you're very familiar with the different corridors or the road alignments in the South Central area, the Glen Highway, the Parks Highway, Kinnick Goose Bay, the rail extension to Point McKenzie. Also, I'm sure you're very familiar with the population trend in the South Central area. About 54% of Alaskans live in the South Central area. There's a little bit less than 300,000 in the Anchorage Bowl area and about 90,000 in the Mat-Su Borough area based on 2011 updated census numbers. The population projections or statistics for the area shows that over the next 25 years, there's substantial growth in the Mat-Su Borough area. Different models show different numbers. They range from about 115% to 119% over 25 years. The other interesting point is that significant growth in the Anchorage area actually occurs from the Eagle River Bridge going north to Klutna. That area over the 25 years also grows by about 74%. Those two growth indicators show that the Anchorage Bowl area is just about out of available land for residential business and commercial and industrial. These are different models. Graphically, it kind of shows you the Department of Labor, an ICER model. There's some discussion over the use of ICER's numbers, and I know Representative Newman was going to address that, so I'll defer to him. The Woods and Pools, which is an independent third-party model, and then Kibata's model. You can see that in 2035, the growth of South Central and significant growth in the Mat-Su Borough area. Sometimes I like to say I look in the rearview mirror to see where I'm going forward, because sometimes it's an indicator of the past. You can kind of see graphically 25 years. In 2010, we used, because that was the census number, 25 years in the past, that's what the population was in Anchorage, the borough, and then South Central. And then you can see in 2035 what our projections show. Shows almost a linear curve, South Central, but it shows a fairly large increase in the Mat-Su Borough. And again, that's availability of land. Now, population, of course, the population comes traffic. Traffic is transportation. Currently at Klutna, and again, I'm looking at a rearview mirror, and I'll give you the next slide, which actually graphically shows you the two locations. Klutna, 1985, was about 16,000. In 2035, it's over 30,000, and their projections in 2035 is over 60,000. At Highland, where the sixth lane is, you can also see the growth there. The growth from 2010 to 2035 goes from 50,000 to over 110,000. Again, that is based on the population projections for Eagle River to Klutna, and then the population projections for the Mat-Su Borough based on the previous slide. But this graphically shows you what's happened in the past from 1985 to 2010, which are actual road count numbers, average daily traffic, and then the projections going forward to 2035.
I have a question that ICER had a population comparison that was different than what you had, and can you explain why there's a difference in those population numbers?
If I could defer to Representative Newman, because I do know that's in his package, I'd hate to take away from his presentation. If he doesn't cover it, I'd certainly be available for the Q&A afterwards, but I do know that he has information on that, and he would like to present that.
Okay, thanks. We'll just wait then.
What happens without a bridge? Again, we looked at the population, we looked at the traffic, and then DOT in 2008 looked at what were the needs based on those population and traffic demands going forward. The Glen from Eagle River North would go to a six-lane to handle the increased traffic or population, and the Glen from downtown Anchorage to Eagle River North would go to an eight-lane or even possibly a ten-lane based on actual traffic counts. The cost in 2008 numbers for those improvements is about $3 billion of federal/match state funding. So in 2008, the estimate that the Department of Transportation had in their long-range plan was about $3 billion in improvements to the Glen Highway. Looking at a bridge option, the delivery mechanism for the bridge is being looked at as a private-public partnership, a P3 model. The scope of that is a private developer, and we do have three shortlisted firms that we've gone through a fairly rigorous solicitation statement of qualifications. So there are three that are currently shortlisted. They are responsible, and I'll say this probably over and over, and please give me your indulgence on this repetitiveness, but they are responsible for financing. They bring the money to the table. They're responsible for financing it, designing it, building it, operating and maintaining it, and collecting tolls. The draft contract that we're currently working on with the Department of Law is a 35-year concession or contract. What the private developer will give us is proposal for availability payments. In order to make this as attractive as they can for their financial market, there are certain things that the state of Alaska are in through this bill and through our legislation is looking to enhance it, and that's the creation of a reserve fund. The reserve fund handles the initial years when we know that the toll revenue will be short of the availability payments. The $600 million, which is safety lieu, private activity bonds. Again, the state is a conduit. We don't secure them. We're not financially obligated to those bonds. All we do is provide a conduit or a obligation for the private partner to go and apply for them. Again, they still have to apply for it. All we do is provide the capacity. And then the TIFIA is the same type of model. We're a conduit. We don't sign for it. We don't have any financial responsibility for it. It's strictly a pass-through. Then also in the contract terms, there is a termination for a convenient clause, which is any point if the state of Alaska decides to exit the contract, which is almost any kind of lease type agreement. The state has the option to go ahead and terminate for convenience, and there's a pay-up value for that. Keep in mind that the bridge from the very beginning to the very end is always owned by the state. So once they start construction on it, it is a state asset. They don't get their first payment until it's called availability payment. They will not get a payment until the bridge is actually open for use. So all during construction and everything else, they're financing it, they're fronting it. Their first payment comes after ribbon cutting. At that point, I can finish up Representative Newman, or I can just turn it over.
Now, I do want to announce that in the audience we have the Senate President, Charlie Huggins, and then Representative Newman has joined us now. So, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to say thank you again to our Senate President who has a companion bill in the Senate. Madam Chair, and members, a few things about this bill that I'd like to address, and some of the safety issues, some of the discussion that's went on, and I'll try and keep it short. We received a letter, you know, at least I did, I think you did yesterday, from Scott Goldsmith from ICER, addressing some numbers and some what he felt some confusion there. And if I can explain that a little bit, just briefly, when those numbers were done by ICER, actually they were below what the United States Census was. And, you know, the U.S. Census does a population total every 10 years in 2010. And so their population forecasts were lower than what the actual census numbers were. And we know that the census numbers obviously can't count everybody on top of that. So if you take the ICER numbers and correlate them, correct them to where the match up with the population numbers that were done during the census, those numbers and the numbers that were projected by Kibata are within 1 or 2%. And we're still talking about numbers that go from about 85,000, 90,000. You know, ICER says, I believe, 170 or something like that, and in Kibata, 190. But there's the bottom line is there's still a lot of people. I mean, you can nitpick about those numbers all day long, but there's still a lot of people. Another thing that I want to bring to the attention is some of the safety issues. And, Madam Chair, I've brought along some accident rates. If I could have your staff distribute to your members, that would help explain some of the routes and some of the safety reasons why this is such an important piece of legislation.
Before you get to that point, there was I think there was another thing in the ICER report that said, and maybe it wasn't that, maybe it was somewhere else I read it, but that said something about the numbers of cars going across were counted as if it was a four-lane bridge instead of the two-lane bridge, and that that. So if you're counting four lanes, then we haven't got the cost of the four lanes in there. And if it's just the two-lane bridge, well, then that would make the numbers difference. I did not quite understand the question at that time, but maybe you can clear it up.
Mr. Foster can look at the design. I don't think the final design has been done yet, Mr. Foster.
Well, after you finish your presentation, I can certainly answer those questions, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And what I wanted to bring to your attention is if you look at the bottom, it's called the fatal and major injury accident rate. And this kind of shows how some of the highways, the highway safety zones, that was of August 2009, and we look at the Pomona Silla on the top right. I want to bring attention to the Parks Highway, Lucas Road, the one from Wasilla to Big Lake. At 17.3 is a major accident rate, and that's per 100 million vehicle miles. Kinnick Goose Bay Road at 22.84. And, you know, we hear a lot about the Seward Highway, yet that's a major accident rate of 13.1. And so some of these major accident rates in some of these areas that we're trying to avoid, and if you look at the smallest, narrowest portion in Cook Inlet, with the little finger that goes up there written under just Kinnick Goose Bay Road there where the bridge would cross, and if you were to go straight north to where it says Wasilla Fishhook, north of Wasilla there, there's currently plans that would look at different routes that would basically run that traffic up that way. And we've provided money to the Big Lake Community Council, the legislature did 2 years ago, to do some plans on how to do that, so that we're working with the local communities on what happens after the bridge is built. And so what we would do, you know, after this bridge is built, is reduce traffic off of that Glen Highway considerably. Right now we have about 30,000 vehicles come from the Mat-Su down that road every year. And the wear and tear on that road is significant. We do rut rehabilitation. The last time we put money on rut rehabilitation on that was about $55 million. And I just talked to Department of Transportation today on that, so I verified that. And we'd have to do that about every 5 years. Now, reducing the considerable amount of traffic that goes in through there, and we're talking a lot of the heavy freight traffic too, you know, because 82% of all the freight that comes into the state comes into container traffic comes into Anchorage, Port of Anchorage. So all that container traffic and all that, those heavy trucks and stuff that would be going toward Fairbanks, Prudhoe Bay, all of that could bypass all of that, which is a major stresses on that road and also reduces the length of that considerably. That's why it has been supported by the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce and points north on there, because they realize the significant savings that we'd have on trucking and reducing traffic, wear and tear on these roads, what the state has to spend on these roads for maintenance. And so if we could reduce that considerably and get it out to 8 or 10 miles, or 8 or 10 years before we have to do rut rehabilitation, that's a considerable amount of savings, Madam Chair. And so then we look at the Wasilla pinch point. And all those of us who live in Wasilla or have been through there know exactly what I'm talking about when they talk about congested traffic into there, because you have Wasilla Lake on one side, you got the highway, and you got the railroad, and then you have Lucille Lake on the other side, and there's just a pinch point there, and there's only just so much room there. And that's been a over-congested highway for a long time, and so we're trying to relieve that congestion to make it safer. And again, we go to Wasilla, to Big Lake, the most dangerous stretch of highway in the state. You know, and we're working to get that into a four-lane right now. But again, relieving the traffic off of that. And we're talking dual semis, a lot of that big, heavy freight that would not have to go in through there. And again, off of KGB also. So the wear and tear on these highways, the safety for Alaskans, reducing these major accident rates considerably by bypassing that, improving traffic, freight, infrastructure, so we can help create, turn Alaska resources into jobs, is very important in what we're doing here. If we were to expand the Glen Highway so that to make that safer, because right now it's over capacity, so if we were to bring it into what it would be to handle expected capacity, the cost on that would be over $4 billion. So again, getting a bridge that's funded by private industry, much less expensive. We look at, again, some of the maintenance on there. It's considerable. We're working with the federal government, with TIFI, and I think Mr. Foster can explain that better than I am. It's federal highway funds under MAP 21 that are available now. And we do have a appropriations that look long-term in support by Governor Parnell on that. And Madam Chair, I think you have this. If not, we can pass it around and get it to you, where he appropriates $10 million this year and then $35 million for the next few years up to 2018 for a total of $150 million. That would create a reserve fund. And Madam Chair, we call this a reserve fund because it's basically a loan. It gets paid back. It's expected within the first 7 years, maybe 7 or 8 years, depending on traffic, and we try and do the best we can to project that, to where the traffic that does start crossing that will increase, and it'll get to a point where it'll be revenue neutral because there's enough tariffs to start paying back this. And again, this would pay back into the reserve fund because for the first 7 years, traffic will be lighter until it starts building up. We get more construction done on the other side of the bridge. Probably housing from the Anchorage area would move over there, Eagle River. A lot of that would be more expansion over there. And as traffic continues to increase north, toll revenues would increase. And in about 7 years, expected to be out revenue neutral. And then it starts to be bringing more revenue back to the state. And that excess revenue, because this is getting some federal funding on there, is required to go to transportation projects. And that can be airports, it can be marine, it can be highways, it could go to a highway fund. You know, and again, in an effort to try and diversify our income revenue streams, where 90% of our revenue is coming from oil, declining rapidly right now, we're $1 billion in hole on our operating budget. You know, we have to find new ways to find revenue. This is an opportunity for the state to put over $1 billion within the first, 20 years or so, into the state revenue that has to go to our transportation projects to relieve the funds of, you know, the congestion off our general fund. And it's done by people who are using this bridge and not coming out of state general funds. So again, trying to again relieve the use of our state general fund, the pressures that we're going to be faced under the economic stresses that we have because of reductions in oil. finding new revenue streams and diversifying our economy, and as this has to be a must. And again, this is infrastructure that would also open up a lot of the development on the western side of the Susitna Basin. Half of the Kenai Peninsula borough is on the other side of Cook Inlet. And this year in the governor's budget, there's $400,000 that he'd put forth to see what is available out there for resource development in the Susitna Basin. Now, having this infrastructure project like this bridge available so we can go out and start developing those resources is absolutely critical to again, diversifying our economy and our revenue streams to the state. So there's a lot of benefits to this besides just the safety to our citizens, but again, diversifying our revenue streams, creating more jobs, finding more opportunities to take and turn our resources into jobs for Alaskans. And again, it pays for itself. And in the end, this project is ready to build. It's ready to go. And hopefully, you know, I try and have a little vision with this, Madam Chair. I look at the state's revenue stream right now, and again, we're in the negatives. We don't have money for capital projects, for large capital projects. The state just does not have that available now. We're $1 billion a hole in the operating. Partnering with private industry to bring in $1 billion of private industry investment to create 1,500 jobs for the next 4 years on this project is absolutely critical to this state. You know, we don't, again, these are jobs. If we don't have job opportunities like this and partner with private industries, the effects on our operating budget are going to be huge. Hopefully this bridge will get us to the time when we're building a pipeline, to a dam, to maybe Donlin. You know, this is a bridge to the future. And I hope that we have the vision to continue on with that, Madam Chair. And I'll be glad to answer any more questions. Thank you for your indulgence.
Any other questions? I don't see any right now. But I do, let me understand, just make sure I understand, because if this all works out like you feel it does, and by the way, I don't mind having the state pay for some capital projects and some infrastructure in the state. Most states pay infrastructure, so I don't mind that, but I just want to make sure that I understand if this doesn't work out and if it doesn't come out, what private industry must be paid for, they're going to pay for this. However, if the tolls aren't enough to pay that, then the state pays it. Is that right?
Under the absolute very worst case scenarios, there has been some projections made, and they're within 5% of what they feel the worst could. I think Mr. Foster could probably explain those better, Madam Chair.
Okay, and that's not the end of the world if we do, because infrastructure, I think the state should pay infrastructure whenever it can. So I'm not concerned about that. I just want to know that the facts that we have are the right facts. And so now, do we have an updated financial plan from you? I know that there's been talk about the feds not maybe funding with TIFIA. And if that doesn't happen and they don't get that loan, then what's the financial plan look like at that point? What's the scenario? And so I kind of would like to know that. And is TIFIA on hold until this bill gets passed? I don't quite understand the correlation there. I've heard several different things, and so I just kind of want to know what the facts are. And so otherwise, I don't have any problems.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we can answer that. And you're right. There was concerns because passage of this bill is critical towards TIFIA, and we did receive a letter. Kubota received a letter September 25 about the state appropriating funding for this project. With that, we have a letter, state seal, signed by Governor Parnell, again stating that, and if I may read into the record.
Sure.
And it says that Mr. Candler, which is again referring back to the United States Department of Transportation from Governor Parnell, I have received a copy of your September 25, 2012 letter to the Kinnickerman Bridge and Toll Authority. In that letter, you state the U.S. Department of Transportation is postponing consideration of our Transportation Infrastructure and Finance Innovative Act, TIFIA, letter of interest until the state appropriates or is reasonably likely to appropriate funding for the Kubota project. As you know, the Alaska legislature has previously authorized the use of federal funds and has appropriated state matching funds to the project. Construction phase included in the statewide transportation improvement program. Kubota is currently purchasing the right-of-way and acquiring the permits necessary for construction. In addition, my capital budget will be submitted to the Alaska State Legislature in December, and it is my intent to include funding for the project reserve. And again, this is a is letter of intent from the legislature for continued funding for the reserve. Kubota will continue to work closely with your office, and the state of Alaska expects full consideration by the United States Department of Transportation in your office and your office for an invitation to submit a TIFIA loan application on behalf of a successful project, signed Governor Parnell.
Okay. So has TIFIA responded back with that?
This was a positive response back to them, and I don't know.
Madam Chair, if I could answer that. They have responded back, and if I could quote something, is and this is a September 25th letter from the U.S. Department of Transportation.
But, excuse me, what was the date on that letter?
This letter was November 15th, 2012, in response to the September 25-12 letter.
Okay, right. And so have you heard from TIFIA since they got the governor's letter?
Yes, and they are waiting for the legislation to pass.
Oh, they said that?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. What's the fiscal note for this then? For your bill?
Madam Chair, there's a zero fiscal note.
But I thought.
Because this again, eventually is a loan that would come back, and the Department of Transportation has put a zero fiscal note on this again because it's a reserve account that I believe it's expected to get paid back, and I don't have a copy of that with me.
So the fiscal note is just because it's a reserve account, which they think that the toll fees will go into, and then whatever the contractor will get all of that, and if there's not enough, then the state puts in the rest?
That's correct, Madam Chair. If I could address a little bit on TIFIA just for some clarifications. The TIFIA program is being administered under the MAP 21, and it's is a continuation of the previous TIFIA, but it has some very significant changes to it. There's $17 billion of eligible money or capacity or cap for the TIFIA program. That $17 billion equates to as a 33% because they have two models, 49% and 33%. But the indication we have from the Federal Highway Administration is that most of these projects will more than likely fall under the 33%. So 33% of a project capital cost is eligible under the TIFIA program. So on a $1 billion project, $333 million would be part of the TIFIA allocation. The $17 billion that they have made available equates to $51.5 billion in capital improvements. To date, there has 26 projects who have submitted a letter of interest, which our bridge is one of them, our project is one of them. It has been, the criteria or selection criteria is a first come, first serve. If you meet the criteria and you're invited to submit an application, then you're basically in the TIFIA funding cycle. And as the projects come in, then it basically lowers that capacity. As I said today, there are 26 letters of interest that have been submitted. None of the 26 projects have been invited to submit an application to date. Out of the 26 projects that have submitted, it equates to 17 different states, including Alaska, that's looking for TIFIA participation. Again, there's $17 billion in capacity, which is $51.5 billion in actual capital money. Now, we have applied before for TIFIA through a letter of interest, even before we had a record of decision. The purpose of us applying for that is to stay in the queue, to keep our project familiar with the major project group out of D.C. for federal highways. We have not been invited on the previous letter of interest to submit an application, nor did we actually expect to be invited to submit because we are still working on the record of decision and our financial model. This project is now mature enough with a record of decision, the permits we have, the right-of-way acquisition, the governor's commitment through his capital budget to initiate the reserve fund, the legislation that we have in place. We're fairly confident, based on all completing all of those items, that we will be invited to submit an application, and that's the next process under a letter of interest. The only other things that we were required to do before we submit an application or before we're invited to submit an application is go out for an S&P rating on the project. We have done that, or the Department of Revenue has done that on our behalf. The rating for this project is a investment grade rating, so it passes the test of TIFIA or the federal loan program. The other determination that came out of the S&P rating was that this project would have no impact on the state's credit rating at all. So the two significant, financial tests that was done by S&P showed the project was investment grade, which is what we needed for TIFIA. And it also showed that the project, under our worst case scenario, had no impacts or did not affect the state's credit rating at all.
And I have to go up to finance to present a bill, and so my vice chair will take over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we kind of swap spots on that because that's where I live.
Representative Creston. Was that a question?
Yeah. When do you anticipate TIFIA is going to invite you to submit a loan application?
Through the Chair, Representative Christ Tompkins. TIFIA has indicated through their letter that until we have the commitment of the reserve fund and legislation in place, they will not invite us to submit the application. We do not want to be in a position to have to submit the application until we have these mechanisms in place, because there's a time clock. There's a 60-day time clock that the Federal Highways, 30 days to respond to tell us whether our application is complete. And then once the application is considered complete, they have a time clock to actually make a determination. We need to have the reserve account initiated. Partially funded through the capital or the governor's budget, and we need the legislation. We have our S&P rating, so as soon as this legislation is in place, we will then be asking U.S. Federal Highway Administration to move our letter of interest into a pre-application state.
Go ahead, follow up.
This seems a little bit like a chicken egg situation, in that my understanding is USDOT says, we don't want to give you a TIFIA loan until the state funds the reserve fund, until the state makes a financial obligation for the reserve fund, which I don't know, you know, what the limits on the reserve fund may or may not be. Whereas it would seem that for us to do our financial due diligence, we want to know what the financing plan for Kibata is, whether or not that TIFIA loan is going to be in place. So, you know, one of these two pieces needs to come first. And I get heartburn for the state to be on the hook for a financial plan that assumes a TIFIA loan that may or may not actually be in place.
If I may, through the chair, Representative Tompkins. First off, we cannot apply for the TIFIA until we have a project, and this bill creates that project. So there's maybe the chicken egg thing, so we're trying to make sure we have a project. As far as the financing mechanism is, again, the projections, they should be in your packet, on toll revenues and where they come there. Again, are there And I point back to some of the bond ratings that were done off of from Standard & Poor's on this. You know, they feel this is a very worthy project, and they're willing to put their money behind it, private money. And so I think that that shows a lot of credibility for this project.
Follow up. I mean, the difference between a low-interest TIFIA loan and, I guess, what a general obligation, I mean, a general bond is, I understand, significant as far as the finance forecast for this project, which is why this project is, you know, really predicated on a TIFIA loan.
If I could answer that through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins. It probably is kind of a chicken and an egg, and I would kind of look at it as almost, you know, pre-qualifying for a house loan before you go look for the house. You know, you go to the bank, you see what you can afford, see what the rates are, you kind of get into, you know, or the chicken for the egg. I don't know if I have the chicken or the egg first, but then I go out and look at, you know, what I can afford and what the house is. In this instance, what the Federal Highway Administration has told us is that, and I quote, and this is in a September 25th letter, it becomes clear that the issue is reasonably likely to be resolved favorably in the near future. And, you know, what that tells us is the passage of this language, the creation of the reserve fund, and the governor's plan to fund that reserve fund. Keep in mind, the reserve fund is not necessary until the bridge actually opens, because that's to cover the traffic. Now, in all due respect, is if TIFIA told us, well, okay, your project is not eligible under TIFIA, okay, we don't have that financial plan. I think Madam Chair had asked about that. At that point, we would have to evaluate whether there is another financial plan that would be as attractive. TIFIA, in some respects, is a gift not only to this project, but the multitude of these 26 other projects. The way the TIFIA structure is TIFIA loans anywhere between 33% and 49% eligible project capital costs. The private partner doesn't make payments on that until it's a greenfield project. They don't make payments on that project or on that loan until the bridge is actually open. And then the initial years, it's a very favorable payment structure because they know it's a greenfield project. Again, the part of TIFIA in this MAP 21 is to initiate new development, new projects, new infrastructure. Okay, so TIFIA, you know, is in a project like this, it is so attractive to the private investor that we are trying to do everything we can on behalf of the state to secure that TIFIA loan. So whether it's a chicken before the egg, I don't know, but we're trying to do everything we can to secure that. Even if a reserve fund is funded completely, until a contract is signed, because there's still several more gates. I know the governor talks to me about different gates we have to go through, different decision processes. Is until a contract is actually signed with a private partner, the reserve fund is just sitting there. And if some point along the road the proposals come in, it's not attractive, or they can't meet our criteria for keeping the availability payment under a curve, a financial curve that we can manage, because it has to be affordable to the state. We have to be able to pay for it through the toll revenue. We are not looking to come back to the legislature every year and saying, okay, we don't have traffic, we need more money, need more money, need more money. So even in the RFP, there's a curve that they have to be under that curve. Okay, if they come to us and say, here's a proposal, and there's three of them, and they say, we can't make that curve, so we're not submitting. Well, that's their choice. Okay, we make that curve, and this is how it works. We don't have a moral obligation, nor do we have a commitment for that reserve fund to be entrusted to the availability payment until that contract is signed.
Mike, so if we could, just for housekeeping, we've got 2 minutes left.
Oh, okay.
And I think we answered the question. And just for housekeeping, just to let you know, it's our intent next week we will be coming on Tuesday to the budget room for a joint meeting with the Senate to hear the previous testimony on the action. Then we plan to come back here. We'll hear SB 31, if they have their updated business plan, and then we'll bring HB 23 back. But we have time for one more question, short question, short answer. Representative Feige.
It's not a short one. And it's not going to get an immediate answer, so we'll ask it next time.
You want to wait till next time? Any other short questions, short answers? Seeing none, do you want to do a wrap-up?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your indulgence, members. You know, and again, I look at the project like this, and just briefly, what do we do if we don't do projects like this, knowing that we don't have money for capital funds to create jobs in our state? This, again, you know, 1,500 jobs for the next 4 years and $1 billion of private industry investment. And I'm in charge of the HESS budget right now. And the amount of people that are getting food stamps doubled in the last 4 years from 08 to 12, from 20 to 40,000. That's a pretty good indicator of our economy. That's when we had $3 billion budgets, capital budgets. Now, we don't have that money for capital budgets. It's so important to bring this private industry in here to help create those jobs for Alaskans. You know, or what can we afford to not do this? What's our future going to look like if we don't have these jobs and this private industry investment? And that's something to think on, I think, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your indulgence.
Very excellent testimony. Appreciate that last comment, especially at this time. It is 3 o'clock, and we are adjourned.